From the macabre minds of Laughing Devil Production comes another story from the Nightshade Diary. You know what that means. Check under the bed and make sure no one or nothing is there. Is the closet door securely shut? Then leave your disbelief behind, amp up your imagination, and hang on tight for another ride into terror and mystery. And like all good horror stories, just imagine it's a dark and stormy night. And remember, screaming like a little girl is permitted. These are true ghost stories from different parts of the world. Indonesia, the stone-throwing ghost of Sumatra. While instances of stone-throwing poltergeists have been reported just about everywhere in the world, they appear to be more prevalent in certain global areas. One of these regions is the Andes chain in Peru, where families and sometimes entire villages have been disturbed by falling chunks of adobe, cobblestone, pieces of tile, lumps of mud, and other objects. Another stone-throwing location is Sumatra in the former Dutch East Indies, today known as Indonesia. Inhabitants of the large island are accustomed to these disturbances, and they are often reported in their newspapers. The late naturalist and psychic researcher Ivan Sanderson once actually played catch with some airborne stones on Sumatra. One of the most remarkable cases of a stone-throwing poltergeist anywhere was recounted by a Dutch engineer in 1903 in the steaming jungles of Sumatra. One respected English psychic researcher called it one of the best observed and most striking cases in history. Another investigator has said that it qualifies as one of the leading poltergeist cases of the early 20th century. It is considered all the more authentic because the engineer W.D. Grotendijk of Dordrecht, Holland, was much interested in science and inclined to be a skeptic in occult matters. His personal account of the occurrences was later published in the British Journal of the Society for Psychic Research in 1906. One day in September 1903, the Dutchman returned to his camp after a long trek through the jungles with some 50 Sumatran coolies. Grotendijk worked for a Dutch oil company, and this had been one of the exploratory trips he had made from time to time. When he came back to camp, the engineer discovered that his regular quarters had been temporarily taken by another member of the company. He had to put up his bed in a new house that had just been erected on bamboo poles. The roof of what was to become that night a haunted hut was of typical Sumatran jungle construction. It was thatched by large dried leaves known as Sumatrees, as karjang, which overlapped each other, shingled fashion. These leaves, measuring about 2 by 3 feet, are very hard and have tough fibers. Grotendijk, worn out from his long march, hastily laid out his sleeping bag and mosquito netting directly on the hut's wooden floor and dropped off to sleep immediately. Later, about 1 o'clock in the morning, he half awoke after hearing something fall near his head outside the netting. 2 or 3 minutes later, he became fully awake and tried to see what it could be that was falling on the floor beside him. Soon he realized that they were small black stones, all less than an inch in size. The engineer then arose and turned up his kerosene lamp. In the illumination, he was astonished to see that the little black stones seemed to be falling right through the tough kajang roofing down into the floor next to his pillow. Wondering what in the world could be the cause of this mystifying bombardment, the Dutchman went into the next room and woke up his Malay servant boy. Grotendijk instructed him to go outside the hut and find out whether somebody was playing a prank on him. While the boy was making his search, the engineer held a small flashlight for him. He noted that the tiny stones did not stop falling inside the hut. They seemed to go straight through the roofing. When the boy returned without having found anything amiss, he was told to search the kitchen. The Dutchman then went back inside the sleeping room to watch the odd falling stones again. He knelt down near his pillow and tried to catch a few of them as they floated through the air toward him. Curiously, he found himself unable to catch a single one. No sooner did he think he had grasped one than it changed direction in midair and veered away. Although they eluded his hands, they still continued to strike the floor beside him. At this juncture, the mystified Grotendieck decided to clamber up the partition between his room and the boys in order to examine the roof just above, the place from which the tiny stones seemed to be emanating. While he could clearly see the stones coming right through the sturdy kajang leaves, he could spot no holes in them. Moreover, when he attempted to catch the stones at the point where they emerged from the leaves, he could not do so. After he had climbed down again, his servant boy returned to announce that there was no one in the kitchen. Still believing that a friend was playing some sort of practical joke on him, the Dutchman grabbed his Mauser rifle and from the boy's room fired 5 rounds into the air above the jungle. In this way he hoped to startle the trickster into revealing himself. But the stones, which were still falling intermittently, failed to stop. After Grotendieck fired the shots, the Malay boy looked into the room where his master had been sleeping, and for the first time, he too observed the falling stones. Thoroughly frightened, he told the engineer that Satan was the cause of it, and then fled into the darkness of the jungle. Grotendieck never saw him again. Furthermore, after the lad's departure, the stones ceased to fall, a fact that suggests the boy himself was probably the energy focus for the disturbances. When the Dutchman knelt to examine the stones, he felt that they were warm to the touch. Still baffled, he went back to his sleeping bag and dropped off again. The next morning, Grotendieck discovered everything as he had left it the night before. On the floor near the boy's window lay the 5 expended cartridge shells. Strangely, however, he could locate only about 2 dozen of the little black stones. Again, he examined the roof, but could see no hole or even a crack in the tough leaves. It crossed the Dutchman's mind that the stones being warm the night before might have been small meteorites. However, he did not see how this could be possible, since they almost certainly would have torn holes in the roof. After the engineer had reported this odd affair to the Society for Psychic Research, some officers of that body, who had become highly interested in the case, wrote back to him posing a number of questions. Point by point, the Dutchman answered them. Here are his answers in his own words. All around the house was jungle, in front, behind, to the left, and to the right. 2, there was no other soul in the house and kitchen than myself and the boy. 3, the boy certainly did not do it, because at the same time I bent over him while he was sleeping on the floor, to awaken him there fell a couple of stones. I not only saw them fall on the floor in the room, but I also heard them fall, the door being at that moment half open. 4, while the boy was standing in front of me, and I shot my cartridges, at the same moment I heard the stones falling behind me. 5, I climbed up the poles of the roof, and I saw quite distinctly that the stones came right through the kajang. 6, the stones, though not all of them, were hotter than could be explained by their having been kept in the hand or pocket for some time. 7, all the stones, without exception, fell down with a certain radius of not more than 3 feet. They all came through the same kajang leaf, that is, all the ones I saw, and they all fell down within the same radius on the floor. 8, they fell rather slowly. Now, supposing that somebody might, by trickery, have forced them through the roof, or supposing they had not come through at all, even then there would remain something mysterious about it, because it seemed to me that they were hovering through the air. They described a parabolic line that then came down with a bang on the floor. 9. The sound they made in falling down on the floor was also abnormal, because considering their slow motion, the bang was much too loud. At many of the Society's subsequent meetings, the strange case was discussed and rediscussed. More letters were written to the engineer requesting clarification of certain points. Dutifully, the Dutchman wrote back, repeating his reasons for believing the boy could not possibly have thrown the stones without being detected. Like so many other poltergeist cases, it has remained unsolved. Grotendieck himself wrote the final chapter to the affair in a letter to the Society. I am afraid that the whole thing will ever remain a puzzle to me. From Ireland, the coffin carrier of Tullamore. Lord Dufferin's strange and fascinating story first began at a country estate called Tullamore, not far from the Irish seaport of Wexford. Lord Dufferin, as a distinguished British diplomat, was not an especially imaginative man. What reason could he have had to invent such a tale? At any rate, the apparition, if such it was, that he saw one night at Tullamore doubtless saved his life. Lord Dufferin had had almost a storybook career. At the age of 15, he had succeeded to the title of Baron Dufferin and Clan de Boy in the Irish peerage. His first important diplomatic success was as British representative in negotiating at Constantinople over the massacre of the Christians in Syria. Created an earl in 1871, he became Governor General of Canada the following year. After serving as ambassador to Russia and Turkey, he was Viceroy of India from 1884 to 1888. In the latter year, he was created Marquess of Dufferin and Ava, and in 1889, he was named ambassador to Italy. Now back in Ireland for a rest, he was relaxing as a house guest of an old friend, the owner of Tullamore. The year was 1890. On this night that he would never forget, Lord Dufferin said good night to his host and climbed the great staircase to his bedchamber. As he entered the room, he was in a mellow mood from enjoying good food, good drink, and good friends. A cheery log fire in the spacious fireplace further enhanced his feelings of ease and tranquility. He prepared for bed and then decided to read for a while. After about 20 minutes, he closed the book and put it aside. Extinguishing the gaslight near his bed, he catnapped for a bit but found himself oddly restless and unable to sleep. This was rare, for he usually fell directly asleep and slumbered soundly until morning. After twisting and turning, he felt so uneasy and disturbed that he got out of bed. Going to the window, he gazed out over the rolling moonlit night across the lawns of Tullamore. There were no clouds, and the light of the moon drenched the neat paths, cropped shrubbery, and sumptuous gardens below the casement window. All seemed perfectly motionless, and the nobleman just stood there for several minutes, taking in the loveliness of the nocturnal scene. Then abruptly, Lord Dufferin saw movement that broke the stillness. Watching fascinated, he saw the figure of a man step out of a long shadow and into the moonlight. Quietly and deliberately, the figure strode directly across the rolling lawn. The nobleman could see that the mysterious man was nearly bent double under the weight of a long and ponderous box on his back. When the bearer of this burden reached the center of the lawn, bringing him into clear view of the watching Lord Dufferin, he paused, lifted his head, and stared straight at the noted diplomat. The moonlight now revealed the full features of the man as his eyes met Lord Dufferin's. So terrible was the face to look at that the nobleman shuddered and recoiled a step or two backward. Dufferin was later to describe the face as full of horror and malevolence. Turning away, the bearer of the burden continued his way across the lawn until he was lost to view in clumps of shrubbery. Only then did it dawn on Lord Dufferin that the man's heavy burden was a coffin. After a few seconds, Lord Dufferin turned away from the window and looked at his watch. It was well past 1 o'clock, and everyone else in the house appeared to be asleep. Everything was as still and quiet as death. Once again, he returned to the window. All was as motionless as it had been before the appearance of the coffin carrier. Not a breath of wind stirred the silent scene. There was little doubt in Dufferin's mind that he had seen an actual person trek across the lawn. He had even cast a shadow. The nobleman had noticed, even so, there had been an eerie, specter-like quality about the figure. Then suddenly Dufferin realized that he was cold and shivering. Baffled by what he had seen, he returned to bed and slept well for the remainder of the night. The following morning at breakfast, Lord Dufferin related his weird experience of the early morning hours to his ghost and other guests, but nobody seemed to take seriously his account of the hideously ugly figure bearing a coffin across the lawn. In 1891, Lord Dufferin became the ambassador to France, a post that he filled for the next few years. One morning he was scheduled to give a talk to an influential group of diplomats on the fifth floor of a Paris hotel. When he arrived, he and his secretary were ushered by the hotel manager to the elevator. Finally, the elevator shuddered to a stop in the main lobby and the doors opened. Dufferin was talking to his secretary and scarcely paid attention to the fact that a number of people boarded the elevator ahead of him. Then, the secretary, seeing the elevator was about to close without them, motioned to his superior to step inside. Lord Dufferin stepped forward and saw the uniformed elevator operator for the first time. The man was facing him and staring straight at him. Dumbfounded and shocked, Dufferin recoiled as he had done at Tullamore, automatically stepping back out of the elevator. The face of the operator was the same tortured face he had seen that night in Ireland carrying the coffin across the lawn. Once again, Dufferin felt the clammy fear he had known on that night. Shaken with disbelief, he waved the elevator away, much to the astonishment of the hotel manager. As he uncertainly waited for it to come down again, he heard a sudden loud clang, then a series of thundering, banging sounds. These were punctuated with a horrible screech and finally by a terrible bone-crunching thud that reverberated through the entire hotel. Later, Dufferin learned what had occurred. The elevator had just reached the fifth floor, his own destination, but its doors never opened there. The faulty suspension cable had snapped, and the loaded elevator had plunged sickeningly downward and crashed at the bottom of the shaft. 5 passengers died in the accident, among them the operator whose hideous face had prevented Lord Dufferin from stepping aboard the ill-fated elevator. When Dufferin made inquiries about the operator, he learned that the man had been hired for that day only, replacing the regular operator. No one knew his name nor where he had come from. Lord Dufferin died in Ireland in Clandeboye in the year 1902. His grandson, a subsequent Marquess of Dufferin and Ava, once remarked about the strange matter. "The story is perfectly true, but my grandfather could never explain it. We have always believed the tale and were puzzled about it, since grandfather did not believe in ghosts."